Chapter 12. The Digital Consumer's Bill of Rights. Foundational Protections. When asked to list America's founding fathers, most of us call to mind six names: Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison, Franklin, Washington, and Adams. But students of history know that George Mason deserves to be included in that list. The Virginian, whom Jefferson called the wisest man of his generation, not only penned some of the most memorable phrases in the Declaration of Independence, but also his retort, "I would sooner chop off my right hand than put it to sign the Constitution as it now stands," led directly to the creation of the Bill of Rights, which limited the newly established government from restricting the freedoms of U.S. citizens, and which remains perhaps the most important of our foundational documents. Historian Robert Rutland notes the following: "Federalist supporters of the Constitution could never overcome the protest created by Mason's phrase, 'There is no Declaration of Rights.' Months later, Hamilton was still trying to kill that snake in Federalist Number 84, but the idea was too powerful. Not long after Mason's pamphlet reached Jefferson's desk in Paris, the American minister was writing to friends at home in outspoken terms. Jefferson told Madison he liked the Constitution but was alarmed by the omission of a Bill of Rights, which the people are entitled to against every government on earth, and what no government should refuse or rest on inference." Having explored the qualities that constitute the impatience economy, its constitution, I'd now like to follow Mason, though without offering to chop off my hand, by proposing a digital consumer's Bill of Rights that will allow the impatience economy and social retail marketing to flourish. Just as the new country needs to establish foundational protections for its citizens to thrive, the new economy, accelerated by the COVID-19 pandemic, creates an urgent demand to codify a set of principles to guide businesses and enable consumers to prosper. And make no mistake, we are living through a revolutionary moment, the second consumer revolution. As Scott Galloway notes in his Post-Corona, From Crisis to Opportunity, in March 2020, we were living in a before era. By the end of the month, we had entered an after stage. A virus 1/400th the width of a human hair grabbed a sphere weighing 13 billion trillion tons and set it spinning 10 times faster. The change has been as dramatic as if we'd been struck by a giant meteorite. Shifts that would have taken decades were now occurring in weeks. E-commerce's share of the retail market had been growing by 1% per year from 2000 to the start of 2020. By January of 2020, about 16% of retail was conducted through digital channels. 8 weeks after the pandemic hit, that number had increased by 69%. That's 10 years of e-commerce growth in 56 days. It's as though we had suddenly been thrust into 2030, equipped with flying cars but with no air traffic control system to guide their movement. My goal in this chapter is to provide that kind of guidance so that buyers and sellers can maximize the benefits of the impatience economy without imploding due to misguided self-interest or, as I explained earlier, the digital commons. I'll focus on the following preamble and five inalienable rights. The consumers of the world have an inalienable right to digital expression, privacy, and ownership of our individual digital identity. We also have the right to choose what, when, where, and how we consume in our pursuit of convenience, lifestyle, peace of mind, and freedom. Number one, the first right is to freely express our views online without being censored by the prevailing sentiment exercised by the ruling bodies of government or business. Number two, the second right is to own our digital identity, actions, and behaviors. Our consumer data cannot be used without consent and fair value exchange. Number three, the third right is to defend our privacy through encryption and intellectual property rights over our own data and consumption behavior. Number four, the fourth right is the freedom to choose, allowing us to control what, when, where, and how we consume anything and everything. And number five, the fifth right is to not have our aforementioned rights infringed upon by paternalistic government regulations or restrictive business policies. The through line connecting these rights is my vision of a trustworthy digital commons in which all participants understand and honor the same set of rules. Unless consumers feel safe enough to express their ideas freely without self-censorship or fear of reprisal, businesses will be unable to anticipate their needs and help them discover new products and services. Similarly, if consumers are wary about how businesses use their data, they may choose to withhold it completely, depriving themselves of a myriad of benefits and depriving producers of enormous profits. Moreover, in a landscape of mistrust, governments will likely step in to fix problems they are ill-equipped to understand, creating a situation in which everyone suffers. My Digital Consumers Bill of Rights seeks to establish a set of guardrails that will prevent these and other problems, allow the free market to bestow benefits on buyers and sellers, unleash the full potential of our revolutionary moment, and discover the new and fruitful opportunities that can emerge from the pandemic crisis, provided we look beyond the tragedy to the opportunities it has created. As George Mason said in response to an earlier challenge, if we behave with enlightened foresight, a few years' experience will convince us that those things, which at the time they happened we regarded as our greatest misfortunes, have proved our greatest blessings. Does this sound like 1801 or 2021 to you? The First Right. How important is the freedom to express ourselves online and to be free from censorship by either tyrannical majorities or the shifting sentiments of governments or businesses? Consider the following statement from legal scholar and longtime American Civil Liberties Union president Nadine Strossen. Social media has become the dominant platform for the exchange of information and ideas. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized in a unanimous opinion in 2017 that the social media platforms are the most important platforms for the exchange of information and ideas and communication, not only among all of us as individuals with our friends and family members, but also between us and government officials and politicians. So it's really important not only for our individual freedom of speech to be meaningful, but also for our rights as citizens in a participatory democracy to have equal access to social media platforms. That is why so many people, so many government officials, so many human rights agencies and activists are thinking very hard and working to implement ways to protect equal and fair access to social media platforms for all of us, even if our ideas are unpopular or controversial. The Congressional Research Service echoes this point in its 2019 report, Free Speech and the Regulation of Social Media Content. One of the core purposes of the First Amendment's Free Speech Clause is to foster an uninhibited marketplace of ideas, testing the truth of various ideas in the competition of the market. Social media sites provide one avenue for the transmission of those ideas. The Supreme Court has recognized that the Internet in general and social media sites in particular are important places for people to speak and listen, observing that social media users employ these websites to engage in a wide array of protected First Amendment activity. For SRM to reach its full potential as a public good, government needs to establish some basic regulations. Not for the sake of Orwell's Big Brother, not to restrict the free market, but for the sake of the consumer, to protect safety and equal access, to safeguard individual users from potential abuses by companies or various bad actors. We have these kinds of regulations in other industries: telecommunications, oil, electricity, transportation, and financial services. But we lack the equivalent for big data and social media. The industry is too new. As a result, companies make their own rules about what we can see, forward, and discover. They can restrict free access across a channel based on their taste, political bias, or capricious sense of right and wrong. SRM cannot reach its full potential under such shifting and unpredictable conditions. To be clear, I'm not advocating large-scale government intrusion. Rather, I side with Milton Friedman's view that government's role is to serve as an umpire to prevent individuals from coercing one another, not to serve as either a participant or as a parent charged with the duty of coercing some to aid others. Just as driving needs clear rules of the road to protect citizens and prevent accidents, so SRM needs to codify and enforce a set of business regulations so the new economy can flower. And only government can serve in this role, just as in, say, the oil industry, where the government sets a basic framework that protects the interests of the consumer and society from potentially unfair or dangerous actions by ExxonMobil, Chevron, and other energy giants. The Economist makes this clear in its October 24, 2020 cover story, "Who Controls the Conversation? Social Media and Free Speech." The journal's editors present an unambiguous conclusion. Free speech on social media is too important to be handled by a handful of tech executives. In noting that societies need solutions today, they recommend that governments define a framework for obscenity, incitement, and defamation, rather than micromanaging individual posts. They wryly note that Facebook recently removed a comment before realizing that it was a quote from the Declaration of Independence. Once a government framework is in place, social media executives, as guardians of the town square, should apply them consistently. When societies are divided and the boundary between private and political speech is blurred, decisions to intervene are certain to cause controversy. The tech firms may want to flag abuses, but they should resist getting dragged into every debate. Short of incitement to violence, they should not look to block political speech. Politicians' flaws are better exposed by noisy argument than enforced silence. Of course, even with these restrictions in place, social media platforms will still need to set enlightened policies. While decent people can disagree on precisely what might constitute the social media equivalent of crying fire in a crowded movie theater, platform moderators need to avoid contributing to the cancel culture spirit that has begun to intimidate social media users into unhealthy self-censorship, what Duke University professor Timur Curran calls preference falsification, which can invalidate the accuracy of social media data and thus reduce its ability to businesses seeking to serve consumers. Supreme Court Justice Louis D. Brandeis warned, "The greatest dangers to liberty lurk in insidious encroachment by men of zeal, well-meaning, but without understanding." In The Quiet American, Graham Greene makes the same point on the destructive sanctimony of the self-righteous Alden Pyle. "I never knew a man who had better motives for all the trouble he caused." In other words, even high ideals can cause disastrous results when mouthed by absolutist activists, whether they come from the public or the private sector, from the right or the left. No single group monopolizes the threats to free speech on social media. It's become a bipartisan effort. A 2020 letter in Harper's Magazine on the growing danger of this trend was signed by writers as varied as former President George W. Bush, speechwriter David Frum, and liberal iconoclast Noam Chomsky. The letter asserts that the democratic inclusion we want can only be achieved if we speak out against the intolerant climate that is set in on all sides. The free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. Censoriousness is spreading more widely in our culture, an intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a binding moral certainty. We uphold the value of robust and even caustic counter-speech from all quarters. But it is now all too common to hear calls for swift and severe retribution in response to perceived transgressions of speech and thought. More troubling still, institutional leaders, in a spirit of panicked damage control, are delivering hasty and disproportionate punishments instead of considered reforms. The result has been to steadily narrow the boundaries of what can be said without the threat of reprisal. We are already paying the price in greater risk aversion among writers, artists, and journalists who fear for their livelihoods if they depart from the consensus or even lack sufficient zeal in agreement. The way to defeat bad ideas is by exposure, argument, and persuasion, not by trying to silence or wish them away. We refuse any false choice between justice and freedom, which cannot exist without each other. The signatory's focus was largely on the sort of speech restriction that occurs on Twitter and other social media platforms. Perhaps unsurprisingly, this straightforward and relatively anodyne appeal for a constitutional freedom met with an immediate and angry backlash by the perpetually outraged on both sides of the aisle. In his 2020 book, Cancel Culture, The Latest Attack on Free Speech and Due Process, Alan Dershowitz notes, "Cancel culture is the new McCarthyism of the woke generation. And as with McCarthyism, the impact goes beyond the canceled individual and affects other members of society. From audiences denied the right to hear canceled performers, to students denied the right to learn from canceled teachers, to citizens denied the right to vote for canceled politicians." Misuse of social media is the driving force behind these cancellations. The second consumer revolution will achieve its full potential only when consumers feel free to express their opinions on these channels without fear of reprisal. The Second Right. If the First Right is about freedom to express your identity online, the Second Right ensures that you own your digital identity, actions, and behaviors, and can prevent the data from being used without your consent and fair value exchange. The First Right ensures that you are not bullied to falsifying your beliefs under the pressure of cultural forces with which you simply feign adherence for fear of being attacked. Doing so may keep the peace, but at the cost of rendering your personal data unreliable for businesses that want to help you discover new products and services. In the terms we introduced in the last chapter, what looks like a meaningful signal from the consumer is actually mere noise. The result is akin to someone sitting down in a restaurant and ordering an entree she detests simply because her date insists it's the best thing on the menu. In such cases, the most astute waiter and the most celebrated chef are powerless to offer her any satisfaction. Similarly, someone who enjoys hunting but professes not to, for the sake of avoiding the ire of his animal rights neighbors, may distort his online profile in a way that limits both his own freedom of choice and the ability of outdoor companies to offer him products he wants, because his self-corrupted data suggests he doesn't want them. The Second Right ensures that you own your digital identity, that the honest data you provide is not broadcast indiscriminately to those with whom you would not choose to associate, and that the companies with whom you choose to share this profitable information, such as Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's, compensates you for your largesse. Each social network generates a discrete digital identifier for every consumer that uses their platform. All the actions, preferences, time spent, clicks made, etc., can be and are tracked for each individual digital identification. Your daily digital online life routine is all recorded, parsed, and categorized for the benefits of advertisers and others who are willing to pay the social networks to reach you, get your attention, try to engage with you, and try to sell you something. That digital identity should be treated like your social security number, your driver's license number, and your credit card number and security code. You give those out when you choose to, when you believe there is a need or a value derived from sharing that personal data. Your personal actions, online behaviors, and preferences, your profile, should be your own personal intellectual property. Your activity record and online data should belong to you so that you are the one to decide how and with whom you interact. Eventually, you should even be able to monetize your personal data and profile. In addition, you should be able to deny access to your digital identification, your personal data, and profile. Today, none of this is the case, and it must change. The notion that personal data has value is a relatively new concept, in large measure because data analytics tools have only recently made it valuable. Jaron Lanier noted the following in his 2014 book titled, Who Owns the Future? We decided not to pay most people for performing the new roles that are valuable in relation to the latest technologies. Ordinary people share, while elite network presences generate unprecedented fortunes. Whether these elite new presences are computer-facing services like Google or more hidden operations like high-frequency trading firms is mostly a matter of semantics. In either case, the biggest and best connected computers provide the setting in which information turns into money. Meanwhile, trinkets tossed into the crowd spread illusions and false hopes that the emerging information economy is benefiting the majority of those who provide the information that drives it. Although there was a predictable lag between the recognition of that value by companies as compared to consumers, that interval has ended. As I've emphasized throughout this book, modern consumers are not naive. They are increasingly aware of the value they provide and increasingly inclined to be compensated for it, whether that be directly through payments or indirectly through convenience or even discounts. During his 2019 State of the State address, California Governor Gavin Newsom made this inclination explicit. California's consumers should be able to share in the wealth created by their data, adding that his team was working on a proposal that would provide a data dividend. A poll of 2,000 registered voters conducted shortly after the speech showed that those who approved of the measure outnumbered those who disapproved by 45% to 28%, with 26% saying they either needed more information or had no opinion. I predict that the number of approvers will increase in the near future as the public becomes progressively more aware of the profits their data provides to others. Proponents like Lanier argue that this change would be a boon to the overall economy and ultimately serve the interests of both businesses and consumers. If information age accounting were complete and honest, as much information as possible would be valued in economic terms. He adds that if raw, unprocessed data isn't valued, a massive disenfranchisement will take place, and consumers' contributions will be unfairly and wisely discounted. He goes on to say the following. In the long term, this way of using network technology is not even good for the richest and most powerful players, because their ultimate source of wealth can only be a growing economy. Pretending that data came from the heavens instead of from people can't help but eventually shrink the overall economy. Lanier's reasoning is hard to dispute. The more advanced technology becomes, the more all activity becomes mediated by information tools. Therefore, as our economy turns more fully into an information economy, it will only grow if more information is monetized instead of less. Even the most successful players of the game are gradually undermining the core of their own wealth. Capitalism only works if there are enough successful people to be the customers. A market system can only be sustainable when the accounting is thorough enough to reflect where value comes from. The Third Right. The Third Right builds on the second by securing the consumer's right to defend their privacy through encryption and intellectual property, IP rights. The history of encryption is both mathematically and politically fascinating, going back to Julius Caesar's coded messages to Cicero, Germany's Enigma machine in World War II, Alan Turing's work to crack the Nazi code, Claude Shannon's mind-bendingly Byzantine 1949 paper, Communication Theory of Secrecy Systems, and on to the current moment when Wired asserts that mathematicians and computer scientists have developed new algorithms that are sufficiently strong to discourage all but the most determined criminals. Nevertheless, determined and resourceful criminals will always be with us, especially when the potential profits from cybercrime are so high. Security companies are not likely to go out of business anytime soon, as they wage an ongoing move and counter-move battle with highly skilled hackers. For our purposes, the main import of this battle concerns consumers' trust. Early on, many consumers were reluctant to make online purchases because they feared releasing their credit card information into cyberspace. Today, almost all of us make such purchases and manage our bank accounts online without giving these matters a second thought. Still, improvements are always possible. Although the figures have remained relatively stable, Federal Trade Commission reports show a slight uptick in identity theft and fraud complaints over the last 5 years. The more fully we guarantee the right of encryption, the greater the capacity of the second consumer revolution to deliver its full benefits to the entire digital ecosystem. The analogy here is to the ongoing struggle between determined biologists, virologists, and pharmaceutical companies to develop new antibiotics and vaccines in the face of ever-evolving drug-resistant bacterial mutations or the emergence of new zoonotic viruses and fungal infections. This isn't a war in which we can ever declare permanent victory since, like those organisms, cybercriminals will continue to adapt to whatever measures we take to defeat them. What we must avoid, however, is an outbreak of deadly digital analogs to MRSA bacteria or the Ebola virus, which, like COVID-19, have the power to shut down an economy. Fortunately, for major issues like identity theft, we have laws to discourage and prosecute human malefactors in ways that don't work against mindless microbacterial threats. Moreover, the private sector offers consumers increasingly robust protections. Anyone who listens to podcasts has heard ads from companies like Norton 360 with LifeLock, which, for a fee of $8 a month, promises to protect consumers from criminals who can file tax returns, steal from investment accounts, or rack up medical bills. Where we lack protection, however, is in the gray area about who has access to consumer data. My third right would grant consumers the power to have total privacy when they want it, just as business executives do when they enter a boardroom to discuss a new product. Personal data and your personal digital identification should be afforded the same protections by law, treating all of it as your own intellectual property. In addition, if you choose to use encryption methods to protect your data, your communications, your personal preferences, and your profile, you should not be seen or treated as a criminal who's trying to hide your identity or actions from the government. For SRM to work most effectively, buyers need the freedom to turn off their digital identities at any time and to engage through social media channels on a private 1-to-1, 1-to-2, or 1-to-3 basis rather than always allowing public access to everything they do with no expectation of privacy. Consumers deserve a right to selective confidentiality, what they expect when they talk to a doctor or a lawyer. They should be able to share what they want with people they trust and withhold what they want from those they do not. And consumers shouldn't be made to feel like criminals for wanting this privacy, such as, what exactly are you trying to hide, any more than citizens should feel sheepish for exercising their Fourth Amendment right against illegal searches and seizures by the government. The landmark protection extended in Map versus Ohio against such intrusions isn't some liberal scheme to protect the guilty. It's a fundamental right of privacy that all citizens deserve and all consumers. In his marvelous satirical novel, The Circle, Dave Eggers pillories those who extend the mindless platitude, "Information wants to be free," by depicting an eerily overzealous and well-intentioned Facebook-like company that creates a dystopia by insisting that, even withholding our most private thoughts from the data gatherers, constitutes a social transgression. Relentless video surveillance and corporate invasions of privacy are seen as the cornerstone of social progress. And absurd proponents of this view chant, in lines that would have been at home in Orwell's Animal Farm, "Secrets are lies, sharing is caring, privacy is theft," at those with the temerity to challenge the totalitarian status quo. Edgar's book is vital medicine for those who too easily dismiss my contention that allowing consumers to opt out of certain data transactions is vital to a healthy digital ecosystem. In other industries, like oil or telecommunications, we have licensing requirements that determine who can do what. But in terms of protecting your digital identity or owning your digital presence or your digital actions, there are absolutely no protections whatsoever. It is free game to anybody who can harvest it and sell it. The only social contract that exists is that by enabling companies to access your data, your digital presence, and your digital actions, you get more targeted, relevant, and contextualized products and services. But that's a very informal, unbalanced protection, and it relies purely on the good business and marketing sense of the sellers. And in a competitive market, that opens the door for some to cut ethical corners and gain a comparative advantage. There is absolutely zero licensing, zero standard set for digital services and management. I keep asking myself the same question. How is that possibly correct? And I always settle on the same answer. It isn't. Not if we want SRM to flourish. We need to be especially vigilant about those companies that simply gather and sell data without any regard for how it's being used. In an earlier chapter, we looked at the ethical problems that could result if a search engine draws reliable inferences about consumers' health based on their queries, and then shares that information with insurance companies rather than with the consumers. That's a separate category from using data to help consumers discover potentially valuable products and services tailored to their interests. In the one case, you're exploiting buyers. In the other, you're acting in good faith to expand their freedom of choice. Clearly, the former requires much more stringent oversight than the latter. That's why we need carefully formulated and enlightened regulatory policies with inputs from consumer advocates, businesses, and government. We don't want just one indiscriminate, heavy-handed set of rules. In my perfect world, governments, tech firms, and consumer advocacy groups would collaborate to establish far-sighted rules. Here, I follow Alan Dershowitz's pragmatic view that we should establish our rights based on our shared sense of the wrongs we want to avoid, rather than on airy visions of unattainable utopias. Our collective experiences with injustice constitute a fruitful foundation on which to build a theory of rights. It's more realistic to try to build such a theory of rights on the agreed-upon wrongs of the past that we want to avoid repeating than to try to build a theory of rights on idolized conceptions of the perfect society about which we will never agree. Working in this manner, we can avoid myopic regulations that favor unsuitable short-term ideals over long-term fairness and prosperity. Recent advancements in AI can be applied to protect consumers and SRM businesses from bad actors and enforce the agreed-upon rules of the road to help keep everyone on the right track. As the nonprofit organization Consumers International advocates, AI needn't be considered a threat, but the enzyme that rebalances the digital ecosystem. By working together, we can ensure that we create an environment where emerging technologies are built with consumer safety, privacy, and security in mind, where digital products and services are as inclusive and affordable as they are innovative. AI is therefore a challenge that consumer organizations can embrace. The November 19, 2020 cover story of The Economist indicates a growing consensus for my third right. Europe's General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, is on the way to becoming a de facto standard outside Europe. With closer collaboration in intelligence, the alliance could be more alert to security threats from hackers and tech firms. By coordinating their efforts on critical technologies, they could specialize rather than duplicate research. By diversifying supply chains and vetting each link, they can protect themselves from accidental or malevolent disruptions. By working together on technical standards such as Open RAN, which uses mostly off-the-shelf hardware for 5G networks, they can create a favorable environment for their companies. Crucially, by collaborating on ethical norms over, say, facial recognition, they can protect their societies. At the end of the day, businesses have more commonality of interest than conflict of interest in maintaining a good, fair, value-driven relationship with consumers. I'm thus optimistic that sellers and buyers can create a secure environment in which both groups prosper in the second consumer revolution. The fourth right. The freedom to choose and to control what, when, where, and how we consume everything and anything has been my focus throughout the previous chapters, so I won't reiterate those points here. My two central tenets are that consumers benefit most from free markets, and that modern information technologies provide an unprecedented opportunity to amplify those benefits by allowing businesses to understand, anticipate, and meet consumers' desires with quick, frictionless responses. Equipped with precise information about consumer preferences, sellers are, for the first time in history, able to help buyers discover new products and services that enhance their lives in ways they could not have been anticipated on their own. My guiding principle has been the collaborative insight of the mathematician John von Neumann and the economist Oscar Morgenstern on the difference between zero-sum and non-zero-sum interactions. In the first, the fortunes of the participants are inversely correlated. The prototypical example is war, in which every advantage for nation X means a disadvantage for nation Y. As Nobel Prize-winning economist George Akerlof has shown, when markets are unfree, when unscrupulous sellers hide information from buyers, information asymmetries turn sales into warlike zero-sum interactions. If I can fool you into buying shoddy merchandise, your loss is my gain. In non-zero-sum transactions, however, the fates of the two parties are linked. If they cooperate, both parties benefit. If they don't, both suffer. As author and journalist Robert Wright notes, economic freedoms harness non-zero-sumness, and throughout history, new technologies have generally increased those freedoms and expanded the number of people who benefit from the system. Milton Friedman makes a related point in Capitalism and Freedom. There is no law of conservation which forces the growth of new centers of economic strength to be at the expense of existing centers. Friedman adds, most economic fallacies derive from the tendency to assume that there is a fixed pie, that one party can gain only at the expense of another. The most important single central fact about a free market is that no exchange takes place unless both parties benefit. SRM thrives on free market non-zero-sum interactions. It is the foundation of the impatience economy. The digital age has effectively removed information asymmetries. Given the synergies of 5G mobile, AI, social networks, telecommunications, and rapid distribution channels, fueled by the accelerant of the COVID-19 pandemic. The social impatience economy has the potential to be the most powerful economic force since the Industrial Revolution. Myriad sustainable benefits can accrue to both buyers and sellers, provided both parties are free to act in their own enlightened self-interest. In my final section, I'll look at potential threats to that freedom. The fifth right. The fifth right ensures that consumers can benefit from the four other rights, unrestricted by government overregulation and capricious corporate policies that curtail basic freedoms. On the corporate side, CEOs looking to cultivate public trust, and if you aren't, you ought to be, should read Intentional Integrity, How Smart Companies Can Lead on Ethical Revolution by Robert Chestnut, former chief ethics officer of Airbnb, which Scott Galloway calls the most valuable private firm in America. Technology has created new integrity dilemmas, Chestnut says. As a lawyer who's worked in public service and in corporations, the evidence is clear to me that proactively addressing these dilemmas is far better than cleaning up the damage they cause. Companies who fail to live by Chestnut's code open the door for overzealous government intervention, which typically does more harm than good, however well-intentioned. To look at one nightmare scenario, imagine what the government might do if businesses misuse consumer data. Legislators could easily step in and declare that every consumer's digital identity must be erased after each transaction. That would certainly solve the misuse problem. But it's the legislative equivalent of burning down your house to get rid of bedbugs. It would leave both businesses and consumers in a pile of bug-free ashes. Unable to form detailed consumer profiles, SRM businesses would falter. And consumers would suffer because, unless those businesses have a personal relationship with them, they can't offer products and services that meet their needs. Or visualize a scenario in which government decides to limit the percentage of commerce that goes through SRM. Or they slap a 20% tax on e-commerce transactions as opposed to a zero tax on brick-and-mortar sales. By taking proactive measures, businesses can avoid this kind of encroachment on consumer freedom. As Milton Friedman says, the role of government is to do something that the market cannot do for itself, namely to determine, arbitrate, and enforce the rules of the game. My Digital Consumer's Bill of Rights aims to ensure that the government does this and nothing more than this. Legislators should determine the rules and consequences, setting the equivalent of the vehicle code that sets the registration requirements, speed limits, vehicle safety requirements, and so on. Beyond that, they should step back and let the players perform. They shouldn't be monitoring us or telling us what routes to take to get from point A to point B. The same is true in business. Government should set the framework and then trust the free market to do the rest. In the last chapter, I'll enumerate 15 key SRM success points as takeaways from this book that summarize how you can win in the impatience economy.